I'm actually really excited about the panel that we have here today. We're really lucky to have the folks that we do. We would actually, this would actually be a really great panel in, you know, DC or somewhere, you know, a little more fancy than Columbus, Ohio. So,
we're fancy. Come on.
This is fantastic. I'm really excited. So I'll just briefly introduce our panelists. We have Vikrant Reddy from the Charles Koch Institute, also Stand Together. Stand Together, for those of you who aren't familiar, Stand Together is the Charles Koch Institute's kind of this collaborative where they're trying to bring a lot of their efforts under one roof, but really trying to make sure that they're removing barriers for prosperity from people. And Vikrant, you can go on about that. But previous to that, he was with Right on Crime. So Vikrant has been working on these issues for a really long time and knows everything about all of these issues. Then we have Jocelyn Rosnick, who's the advocacy director from ACLU Ohio. Jocelyn is fantastic and again knows all these things that are going on and is great to work with. I'll introduce Holly when she gets here, but we have Professor Doug Berman from the Ohio State University Morris College of Law and is also the executive director of the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center there and is an expert in all things federal sentencing and is probably the foremost expert in those issues in academia. So with that, I just wanted to open it up to everyone and just ask, what are the trends that we're seeing nationally? So Ohio is not in a vacuum. We're working on criminal justice reform efforts, and we're seeing those happen at the federal level. We're seeing them happen in all 50 states. So Vikrant, can I start with you and just talk about what are we seeing nationally and why?
A lot of things. I mean, we could do the whole panel on that one question. I'll say this. I think for a long time, you know, we've been seeing criminal justice reform happen at the federal level in states all over the country. We just kind of say criminal justice reform very broadly. But there's enough interest in the issue now that we're starting to get a bit more specific in what it is that we're really interested in. And what I'm seeing, what I'm optimistic about, is a bit of a trend towards more front-end reforms rather than back-end reforms. So what we mean by this is, on the back-end side, there has been for quite a while now a lot of agreement that people who are trapped in the criminal justice system, we need to find a way to help them get out, we need to help people re-enter society safely and successfully, and even people who are very skeptical of criminal justice reform, probably the most skeptical major American figure of the last 10 years, Jeff Sessions, the former attorney general, even people like that have said, I'm comfortable with doing more on re-entry. So we've kind of been pursuing that angle for a little while now. But I feel like things are changing. I feel like the trend line now is people saying, instead of trying to save people who are trapped in the criminal justice system, why don't we do what we can to prevent them from falling into it in the first place? I like that move. I think that's absolutely the direction that we want to go in. So you could see that manifest itself in at least two ways. First of all is a lot of attention around policing and the question of the interactions that people have with law enforcement from the get-go. How are those interactions initiated? Do the police show up because somebody called them? Do they just see something and decide to take action on their own? What happens in that interaction? How do police officers act? How are they trained to act? There have been a lot of really unfortunate police abuse incidents. I'm from Texas. Some of you heard about some of the terrible ones down there, these awful shootings where somebody just opens a door and is shooting into a home because supposedly they were trained that way. There have been terrible incidents that have happened here in Ohio also. I think there's a lot of concern about the policing question. We're starting to dig into that. I also think the question of jail as opposed to prisons and how we handle that part of our system, how we handle bail is being addressed in a lot of places all over the country. Every country has some level, not every country, but just about every country has got some level of cash bail somewhere in their system, but virtually no country on earth has what the United States has, where it is used so extensively and so deeply. other nation that has that is the Philippines. That's a weird bucket for the United States to belong in, the US and the Philippines. So these are the kinds of questions that I think fundamentally people are trying to address, the question of how to keep people from falling into the system in the first place. That's the broad trend line that I'm seeing nationally.
I'm going to skip over to Professor Berman. Professor Berman, can you talk about federally what we're seeing? We've had, I can only think of two really criminal justice reform bills in the last 10 years that we've seen, one recently. But can you talk about what's going on at the federal level?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's interesting in this context is, and maybe it's true in other substantive contexts as well, is the federal system is both a follower and a leader. And one of the reasons why the federal system has always been, for me, a focal point of my research and work is because it plays both of those roles. Lots of times, work we'll see at the federal level will come after states have pioneered successful reforms or have sort of built the foundation for change. And I think we've seen that the most prominent recent federal reform is the First Step Act, signed by President Trump, passed by both houses of Congress overwhelmingly back in December 2018. And that very much built expressly and in lots of ways kind of politically implicitly on successful reforms at the state level. And that was in both red and blue states. And part of the success was people supporting a range of reforms, many of that Vikrant was talking about, in red states and still getting reelected. You know, the reality of what we saw for pretty much a generation was not only a belief, but a realism that you never got voted out of office federally or often at the state level for being too tough on crime, and you always got attacked, whether justifiably or not, for being too soft on crime. That was the sort of political zeitgeist, and again, it's part of the feds being both leaders and followers. You know, many people who serve in Congress spend time at the state level in a variety of political or legal, oftentimes criminal justice roles, and so they sort of inculcated that attitude, and it took close to a generation of new leaders or sometimes old leaders like Jeff Sessions to kind of discovering not just the range of problems with the sort of tough on crime philosophy, but especially the bills coming due. And we even heard the Governor's Counsel, Andy Wilson, sort of, you know, talk about some of the economics of this, and what I think it really fundamentally gets to is something that's been true in our nation, in just about every nation, for as long as you can think. Prisons are very expensive and not very effective. It's a very kind of simple idea, but a simple idea that makes it not that hard for people who really study the policy to say things like, we really need to be doing better both on the back end, try to make prisons more effective when we're going to use them, and on the front end, using them less because they're expensive and because of how challenging it can be to make them an effective kind of long-term solution to crime problems. But for politicians, it works the other way. Promoting tough-on-crime approaches tends to be very effective for their short-term political interests, and the expense is borne over time when they're not cutting the checks, and especially at the federal level. This is the last part to be particularly kind of intrigued about when you look at it, as I do in the academy, from 30,000 feet. The thing that made the federal level historically so tough for doing significant criminal justice reform and try to shrink our carceral footprint was the fact that the feds print their own money, and they don't worry about that. And the discipline that comes from having to balance a budget, having to worry about how much that next prison costs, that was never in place at the federal level. And so we needed a sea change in the politics. We needed changes in kind of attitudes about approaching these issues in order to have that ultimately have the impact at the federal level that was needed to get something like the First Step Act, which was widely supported on both sides of the aisle. But many people would say, myself included, that that's, you know, not only called a First Step Act, but not nearly enough. Hello, Holly, come on in and join us. and so, you know, that's where valuably, and I think somebody mentioned it even earlier today, may have been Senator Obhoff, that the passage at the federal level, the First Step Act, may have cleared some space for states that have been themselves moving forward with reform, accelerating the pace of that. I hope that then ends up reflecting back on the federal system, because there's a need for a Second Step Act and a Third Step Act and a Fourth Step Act, and yet, though I'm a big fan of incrementalism, you do take some of the energy out once you have the challenge of implementing effectively a new big bill like we see at the federal level. And so there's always more work to be done. I only half jokingly say it means I'll always have a job to understand what's going on and see where it's headed. But I think one of the things that I continue to see more and more is just the way in which there's not distinct federal and state systems. They're working in synergy, in harmony, and moving in fits and starts together. And so while we're here partially talking about Ohio's experiences with issue one and the drug sentencing bills, it's necessarily a federal story. And seeing Holly nod, she knows so well because she works on both levels so hard. That everything that's being done, not just at the state level, not just at the federal level, at the local level, ends up kind of echoing through the system in powerful ways. And it's why, there is always more work to do, because it's both getting the laws changed, but then it's implementing it effectively, and then telling the stories about efficacy that itself will then inure to the next round of reform.
So I think that leads perfectly into my next question for you, Jocelyn. We're talking primarily today about sentencing reform involving drug possession and those kind of low-hanging fruit, I guess, things that hopefully all of us can agree on. The ACLU has put out a report looking at each state, how it can significantly reduce its prison population. And I think that's something that you and Gary talked about in one of our previous panels, that it's going to take more. So can you talk about that?
Sure. I think we need to realize that across the country, there are about 2 million people that go to bed every night behind bars, right? These are individuals that are in our prisons and our jails across the country. That's not a small number. That's quite a large number that has been ballooning for decades. And so we can't just think about the very easy low-hanging fruit and the publicly palatable reform. We have to have serious conversations about the effect of, 50 years of the failed war on drugs and what that's done to communities and neighborhoods and individuals all across the country. So at the ACLU, our vision for criminal justice reform is really one of smart justice. That means that we look at two sides of the same coin. We're fighting to combat the racism that is inherent in the criminal legal system, as well as try to decarcerate our jails and prisons by 50%. And that is an extremely lofty goal, and we realize that. So when you're going to have that kind of ambitious goal, you better be able to talk about how to actually achieve it. So the National ACLU partnered with the Urban Institute, and using Urban's new forecasting tool, took a look at every single state across the country and figured out how to actually reduce the jails and prisons in that state by 50%. And it was a pretty enlightening process. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It simply won't work. The reform that's needed in California versus New York versus Maryland versus Ohio, West Virginia, Florida, it all has to look a little bit different. Here in Ohio, one of the biggest things that we need to do is look at technical violations. I'll get more in depth to that in a minute, but the other thing that we found when we were looking into this research is that if you're only looking at that one side of the coin, if you're only focused on getting more people out of jails and prisons or stemming the tide flowing in the first place, you're really missing the point. Because when you're just focusing on lowering those numbers, you can actually make the racial disparities that are inherent in our jails and prisons already worse. Depending on the types of offenses that you're looking at, you could get a bunch of individuals out, but we know from the research that you're going to be letting white individuals out, and individuals of communities of color aren't going to benefit from those reforms. They're going to get left behind. And so going back to technical violations, which I know was a big topic of conversation at an earlier panel, really is one way in Ohio that we could actually reduce our prison population pretty greatly by about 20%, depending on how broad we were in terms of our reform. But it will also get to the heart of the racial disparities that are inherent in our system.
Great. So I I'm so glad that we have Holly with us. Holly Harris is the
executive. I try to come late, so then all the hard questions go to everybody else.
Holly Harris is the executive director of the U.S. Justice Action Network. It is the largest bipartisan criminal justice reform organization that I know of, and I think that's true. If there is something criminal justice reform going on, whether at the state law level or at the federal level, Holly has something to do with it. She was instrumental in the First Step Act and doing a lot of reforms, including reforms here in Ohio. So we're very grateful to have Holly with us. Holly, you work at the state level, you work at the federal level, you're really involved in these issues, and you do so on a bipartisan basis. How did we make this change to getting to bipartisan consensus that criminal justice reform is something that we need to be looking at?
Well, the whole reason for the bipartisanship is it's not to make everybody feel good. You know, it's not like Red Rover. It's nothing like, it's strategic because, you know, politics will shock you. And I got a Matt Bevin story from Kentucky that I'm going to share here in a minute. But you know, that the beautiful thing about having the diversity of voices at the table is that you always have a voice then that you know, can speak truth to power, and a voice that is trusted by the powers that be. So I do want to share. I have a real got a deep concern this morning that I just want to share with all of you all. Of course, Kentucky had its gubernatorial election last night. It does appear that the Democrat, Andy Beshear, prevailed, even though Kentucky, I assure you, is a deep red state. You know, there are a lot of people are sort of pontificating about, you know, like, why did he lose and whatever. And Trump came in the night before and there were like tons of people and, you know, and you know, some people are saying, well, you know, is Trump even really that popular? Well, yes, in Kentucky he is. There's something that happened with Bevin. You know, Matt Bevin is one of those leaders that has, I mean, really talked the talk on criminal justice reform. I mean, he has just been out there saying all the right things. But in the waning days of the election, he went to Wheelwright, Kentucky, and reopened a for-profit prison that had a very tragic history. There were many rapes of women that had been covered up. The prison had closed down. And yes, we have prison, we have jail overcrowding, and there were some legitimate reasons to reopen the facility, although I would not have. I would have done other things. But he and his team, I think that the biggest issue was they went there and they said, this is innovative economic development. And it just broke my heart, you know, because he reverted to this old school 1985 campaign sort of like rhetoric that all these politicians still think that this works. And, you know, look, man, no state has been more ravaged by the drug scourge than Kentucky. Our voters are actually pretty well educated on these issues. And it was insulting. It was an insulting thing to do. And I'm sorry, it's not at all responsive to your question, but it's just sort of been plaguing me all morning, you know, that we've come so far with this bipartisanship and we put polls in the field all the time. We talk about how popular criminal justice reform is, and yet, you know, the governor who had is probably the greatest advocate for this stuff felt like he had to go the other direction in the waning days of the election. And for what? What did it get him? We've reopened this terrible, terrible place where these terrible things happened, and he lost. It wasn't worth it. So thank you for that therapy session, and I'll be sending checks to all of you.
Well, I'd love to follow up with the point that I've lately been making, perhaps too much, is this bipartisan moment in support of reform is very fragile. And it's fragile in so many different ways, right? And so, you know, among the things my news feed came up with today is apparently there's now a federal bill on President Trump's desk to make animal cruelty under certain circumstances a felony at the federal level. And that has nothing to do with keeping communities safe. I don't think it really has anything to do with keeping Fido safe. I think it has a lot to do with, this is the way in which we do something, right? And I think at the end of the day, that's the part to particularly appreciate is most politicians come into office with a true commitment to do something, and it's dangerously easy for that do something to be, let's open a new prison or let's pass a new tough law. And I think it's been an incredible transition that the do something has been, let's fix our broken criminal justice system. And I would say another piece of the sort of broader story here is it got rightly perceived as broken only when it broke a lot of people that people now know, right? It always broke marginalized communities, and yet there were not enough of those with enough political power to make a difference in the average politician's life. But even, you know, hearing the governor's counsel, Andy Wilson, tell his story of how collateral consequences has hurt this very successful person that he grew up with, you know, is just one of a number of examples of how this has become personal for so many, that's created this window of opportunity, but we got to keep sort of moving through it and do it with an understanding that those old political instincts and the forces that got us into a universe of mass incarceration, mass criminalization, haven't gone away. And in fact, they're kind of always at risk, whether it's, you know, the opiate crisis, whether it's whatever the next concern is, it's gonna be there, and it's only from the folks who do this work in this room continuing at it and taking as many victories as they can and keeping to log roll that, that we can hope to keep moving forward as effectively as the last couple years have demonstrated.
So that leads me to my next question. So crime is near historic lows. In fact, just a few weeks ago, FBI released the latest data. Crime almost completely across the board was down. And so that's really good for those of us who advocate for criminal justice reform. Eventually, if it goes the way that it has historically, we are going to see an uptick in crime at some point. This carceral reaction to an uptick in crime when and if we see one. How do we keep the momentum for criminal justice? How do we stop politicians and the public looking at the criminal justice system as a way to change cultural behavior?
Well, I have an unsatisfying answer. And I'll refer to something that happened in the previous panel. There was a woman during the Q&A, and I don't see her now, who asked questions about the sealing of records. And there's a bit of a kind of back and forth between her and the panelists on the extent to which these records are really sealed. And one of the panelists said something that I thought was very insightful. He said, at this point in the year 2019, it's not even about whether or not the record is sealed or unsealed. It's about what you can find on Google. That's really where people are going for their information. He's right about that, and he's right that just because of technology, certain things are just always going to be out there. It's going to be virtually impossible to use law to stop those kinds of things. So if you can't use law, you can't use legislation, you can't use policy, you have to use culture. Like I said, this is an unsatisfying answer because I don't know how to just change culture by signing a bill or doing something like that. But you really do have to change the culture to where when you do have a slight uptick in crime, and you're right, it'll probably happen, people are able to absorb that without overreacting. What you want is for people, just on a day-to-day level, if they meet somebody who has been behind bars for a small period of time, that they don't overreact, that they are willing to hire that person, that they're simply willing to be friends with that person. Things like that at a very basic cultural level are what we need to have happen in order to make sure that these gains continue and that we don't have backsteps. But like I said, I recognize that that's an unsatisfying answer. It's hard to know how to do the cultural change, but that's what we need fundamentally.
So I was doing some reading recently, and I stumbled on an article, I think on The Intercept, where there was an interview all about incarceration and what it means and how do we, you know, stem the tide and what does this mean for the future. And this is a little cheesy, but I actually think it's a great example. So the speaker said, incarceration is buying you some time, but the underlying issues and the cause of the offense in the first place, you're just putting it off, right? You're putting people in a place and saying, we're gonna deal with this later. And you can relate it to finances. It's like a credit card bill. So say you're having a rough month and you can't pay your bills, but you have a credit card. So you say, I'm just gonna put everything on the credit card and great, next month everything will be well, and I'll pay it off, right? then the next month rolls around, everything's not wonderful, and you can't pay it off, and now you have interest, right? So long sentences are like that. Not only are you incarcerating people and locking them up and essentially throwing away the key, you're not making them better, and then you're setting them up to fail when they come back out. And so I think, hopefully this is a slightly more satisfying answer, that one of the things that we really need to do to push the culture change is to focus on prevention, to focus on treatment instead of incarceration, and not treatment that's only routed through our criminal justice system when we're talking about the drug policy context, as well as looking at the underlying root cause of the problems that we're seeing in terms of offenses and crime generally, right? It doesn't come out of comes from lack of access of opportunities, right? Focusing on
no one else want to respond to that?
That was awesome.
Great. So two more questions, and then I'll open it up to the audience for audience questions. First, and I think that nationally, when it comes to criminal justice reform, are we a leader? Are we behind? Are we somewhere in between? Where do we stand?
I think you could answer that question many different ways. We're certainly not at the back of the pack. We're not, you know, charging ahead at the front, and it really is issue specific. Criminal justice is a huge, broad category with many subcategories. I think if you look at the realm of pretrial reform and bail reform, as well as drug policy, Ohio is being cited in a blog post I see from the Vera Institute as actually being a national leader. Yet we also are lagging woefully behind in areas like access to earned credit and early release. So I think, you know, depending on which specific reform area you look at, you get a very different response. People always ask me about bail reform because that's the current hot topic here in Ohio. And today, actually, the Supreme Court of Ohio closed a public comment period on Criminal Rule 46, which is the procedural rule related to bail. And I'm happy to say we submitted our comment. We're excited about the opportunity for reform, but we hope that it would go further and got 50 other individuals and organizations to sign on with us. A lot of folks are scared of the reform, are thinking of the what ifs and every example that they can think of. And my response is, Ohio's not going to be the first state. We already know there are several other states that already are well ahead of us in terms of bail reform, but we're certainly not going to be the last. And so that gives us the opportunity to learn from some of these other states that came first and to make a better example for the states that are going to follow.
Holly, I'm going to tweak this question slightly for you. You work with legislators across the country. How is working with legislators in Ohio? Are we more receptive, less receptive, somewhere in between?
So, I mean, I just cannot stress enough how lucky Ohio is to have Senate President Obhoff, who really, if you sit down and you have a conversation with the man, I don't know what anybody's politics are in the room, but I mean, you know, if you talk to him about criminal justice reform, I mean, he speaks about it very academically and has a really deep understanding of data-driven reforms. And the fact that he wants Senate Bill 3 to be his legacy and is so committed to ensuring that that bill, you know, gets across the finish line before he does, is really a testament to, you know, a person who is really not afraid of the political consequence, although again, we'll go back to the Bevin story. And he truly wants to do what is right in this space for the people of Ohio. I mean, John Eklund, another one who's fantastic. I mean, obviously, you know, O'Brien is wonderful. I mean, there's so many. And the other thing about Ohio that I've really enjoyed is like, there really has been no pushback to bipartisan work. Could be because you got super majorities and who cares, but like, I've really enjoyed, you know, watching the right and the left stuff work together, and now they'll fight like, you know, crazy on other things. But, you know, you really do have, you know, strong consensus here on the right and the left. And every year that we've engaged in Ohio, and what, you guys are one of our first target states, right, Kevin? So this next year will be our fifth year in Ohio. But every year we've been able to be a part of helping to pass significant legislation. It's all been different, you know? I mean, I was most proud of like the targeted community alternatives to prison, which, you know, TCAP, what we called it, it was, and it ended up in the budget. But like, you know, I just feel like there have been so many great accomplishments here, and as goes Ohio, so goes the country. Y'all probably said that already. But I mean, it's just, it's a crown jewel in our work, not because the most significant reforms have passed, but really because there is consistent reform happening. It's happening in a bipartisan way, so it is going to be sustainable.
Great. So my last question to the panel, and then audience questions. What's the biggest obstacle nationally to criminal justice reform? What are we looking at? What do we need to overcome to take us the rest of the way? And that's for anyone.
I'd have slightly different answers, you know, federally versus working in individual states, but I do think that that core political reality that it's always going to be easy for, you know, even somebody who in other respects has been very committed to criminal justice to, hey, it's good politics to now sort of scratch that tough on crime. I think there's been reports that President Trump has been disappointed he didn't get enough credit for criminal justice reform, and others are taking advantage of that, and it didn't give him a bump in, you know, his base. And so the politics is always going to be challenging. And again, it's, you know, it runs exactly the other way when it's the animal cruelty felonization, because there's always a sense of, I'm sure I'm going to be able to go campaign on this with a soundbite and have people raw my efforts to take care of the vulnerable. We even heard it, you know, in the conversation from Andy Wilson, that Governor DeWine's commitment is, you know, to keep safe vulnerable populations. It's very hard to convey that message that reducing the number of people in prison does that, even though evidence suggests that may be true. It's much easier to say I passed a law and did that, and I think that's going to always be there, always be lurking, always be a challenge, and always ensures that there's a bill out there introduced by somebody that's going to be awfully hard to resist signing on to, that says enhance the penalties for this problem, or here's the latest crime that just took place, let's roll that into some other bill that's going on. And you know, I think the ACLU's work on the state house to prison pipeline, you know, shows that even within a really, what I think is a really good legislature that gets this stuff, there's always going to be those bills that make the rounds. And ironically, and this is, I think, one of the, you know, sort of both most depressing and yet inevitable parts of the story, if you come back and say, well, you really don't need an animal cruelty bill, it's only going to affect 8 people, and, you know, those are probably going to be weird cases, and it's just a dumb thing to do. It's like, well, then why are you worried that I'm trying to do this for politics? All the more reason. Tell me it's ineffective because it's not going to make much of a difference. All the more reason I want to get the political bang out of it without worrying about the practical impact. And so I just persistently worry about the politics, even more than the uptick of crime. Because even when crime is low, it's very easy to say, well, crime should be lower still, and still kind of have a hard response to the latest bill that suggests doing something along those terms.
And I'll just say, the for-profit prisons are one of the greatest obstacles, and here's why. I see these advocates on Twitter all the time saying, oh, well, there's not a significant portion of the incarcerated population in for-profit prisons, and this isn't the problem. Yeah, what you're overlooking is the significant political engagement of those entities. Each one of them, there were three or four for-profit prison corporations who gave $250,000 apiece just to Trump's inauguration. And when you start tracking their political giving, it is unreal. And they're very surreptitious in their opposition to bills. And so, and much of the money that they give is dark money. So, you know, obviously if they're getting paid per diem,
you know, for their for the inmates that they house. I mean, obviously, they are not in favor of significantly reducing the incarcerated population because that doesn't fit within their business model. So it's the political engagement of those entities that I think is so difficult to overcome, because really very few of our organizations do strategic political giving, very few. And, you know, when you have bail bondsmen giving to ensure that bail reform doesn't move forward, and then you've got for-profit prisons and all the for-profit entities, you know, that are out there, you know, giving significantly to politicians to ensure they don't move reform bills forward. I mean, on top of all the other things that we've got to, you know, be concerned with, I mean, that is a really significant issue. And we've got to, you know, either be calling it out, or we've got to be willing to, like, step up and be supportive in a real way of those elected officials who are going to be taking it on the chin, you know, from those groups.
Can I just say everything she just said? Because I agree, and for several years was working on prison privatization here in Ohio. We're still the first and only state to have actually sold a prison to a private corporation. Many of them have contracts and have management, but the state of Ohio sold the Lake Erie Correctional Institution to what's now known as CoreCivic, but then was the Corrections Corporation of America. Additionally, I think there are two words that haven't been said yet today, and I'm a little shocked: data collection. I think that data collection is a really big hurdle federally in many states, but especially right here in Ohio. We don't have a unified court system. Everybody keeps records very differently. I send a lot of public records requests. Some of them never get a response. I have received handwritten notes, scans of information that is collected just on legal pads. And it makes it very difficult to actually do robust data analysis here in Ohio to make the case for reform, right? I think all of us want to live in safe and healthy communities. I think all of us want to implement reform that's going to be effective and efficient and is going to get us there while keeping communities safe. And it's very difficult to do when you're constantly only seeing kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of the information that you should have to work with.
Karan, do you want to respond to that, or?
I guess I'll say, I want to try and say something new, something different. So I'll say, when you said the two words that that you thought you'd hear that you hadn't heard yet, that you wanted to announce, I thought you were going to say mental health. Because I think that's a huge part of the criminal justice problem in this country. Once you start kind of digging into the criminal justice issue, you dig deeper and deeper and deeper, you just always find yourself back in mental health problems. And I don't want to overstate the case, but just an overwhelming percentage of the time, that's what all kind of comes back to. So you want to be sure that your society is funding the mental health resources, the mental health capacity that it needs to have in order to take some of that pressure out of the criminal justice system. Until we really show full commitment to doing that, we're just going to keep kind of reverting to the criminal justice system as our catch-all net. And I think that's one of the really big problems. One of the big obstacles to reform right now.
All right, great answers. So we have a couple minutes left for audience questions. I'll just remind you that a question is usually one or two normal length sentences, and you are trying to elicit a response. So with that, if we could get a couple questions, we'll take those.
Thank you for that question. I think there's a lot that we can be doing better. I think there does need to be some sort of unified system, or at least a bar, right? That this is the information that everybody is going to collect. I think a great example that came up earlier is drug courts in Ohio, right? We know that there's funding for an additional 30 drug courts, that we're spending an awful lot of taxpayer dollars on drug courts. And in terms of legislation, individuals often during testimony herald drug courts as being the answer. Yet, we're actually looking into this at the ACLU. The last statewide study was in 2002, right? And it's very difficult to get data in terms of success rates, you know, who's in which drug court and why, what sort of access to medically assisted treatment is in, you know, court A versus court B, you know, what does access look like based on geography, and the limitations to even just access the court generally. Additionally, drug policy, it's a huge hot topic now. There's legislation related to that. You could determine how many individuals are in Ohio prisons for an underlying drug offense, right? And you can determine what level felony, or for, you know, jails, what level misdemeanor. But you can't break it down further. You know, which specific substances? You know, is this the first offense? Is it the second? I think that it's, you know, we have one layer of the onion, but we're missing the rest.
Well, we tried in Michigan, and that was the one bill that the governor vetoed. And the governor vetoed the bill because all of the judges leaned in. Oh, I'm sorry. We're in the, like, the Supreme Court building.
That's okay.
Deepest apologies to all the judges. But the judges leaned in Michigan because they didn't want, you know, the data on their sentencing patterns out there. And so, you know, there is a lot of, and it's funny because, you know, when we talked about a data collection bill, and it was a part of a package of bills that I think John Prose, who's no longer in the legislature, but it's Senator Prose, had moved this, you know, package of bills. I mean, we really thought that would be the least controversial, and yet it was the only one that the governor vetoed, and again, it was because of the judge's opposition. And by the way, since we're on the topic, it has been disturbing to me. There's been a lot more judicial engagement at the legislature on reform bills. We've certainly seen a lot of it in Kentucky. You know, obviously, you know, we've seen some judges come out in opposition to Senate Bill 3. And I'm a little troubled by that. You know, like, that's kind of a newer thing where these judges are actually actively going to the legislature and testifying and sort of doing advocacy, opposing reform legislation. It feels very inappropriate, especially when a lot of these judges are going to be, you know, deciding a lot of these cases, you know, after a lot of these reforms pass. So, and that's just something to think about, because I'm still not really sure what we do about that. I know there's, like, ethics rules, but then it's like the judges are the ones who determine whether they, like, violated the ethics. So, you know, fox watching the hen house and all. So, just something, I think, and yet another obstacle.
Well,
I think.
I'm so glad Holly opened that can of worms, which I'm now going to eat at dangerously. I actually think in the broader landscape, and this is watching both the federal and state systems, the role of judges as both resisting existing pushes, right? We've seen that in Ohio with TCAP and other forces where a lot of very effective, what should be very effective bills have lost their efficacy because judges haven't implemented them in, you know, both a variety of conscious and maybe subconscious ways. But even more fundamentally, judges historically, even as we are in a reform era, and I hope it's an era and not just a few years, are not at the forefront of that. They're actually behind it, despite the fact that they have the tools at the federal system, also at the state system, to do an awful lot more. And I'd like to think that that's exactly what they're there to do. Now, it's hard in states with an elected judiciary, though not impossible, especially at the federal level. I've been persistently disappointed at the lack of courage we've seen among the federal judiciary in either being at the forefront, I'm thinking especially about our federal circuit courts, of reviewing long sentences under the existing federal rules that are there, or in their eagerness to reverse courageous district judges who have been trying to be at the forefront of a lot of these sets of movements. And I'm not sure I have an answer to that problem as much as it is interesting, and I've mentioned this and making a habit of mentioning it. We're seeing this robust progressive prosecutor movement, and you might have a variety of views of that. Our current attorney general has spoken out against it, but I think it's sort of interesting and problematic that folks who are very vocal as advocates for reform and who are backing this progressive prosecutor movement haven't thought about a progressive judges movement, because there's work that needs to be done. One variation of that theme that fits into the judges of the problem is the Cato Institute just did a big report highlighting that I think it's something like 8 times as many federal judges have history as prosecutors and have history as defense attorneys. That's just not fair and balanced, to quote my favorite television station. And so, you know, thinking about the roles judges play here, maybe as breaks on others moving forward with reforms, at failing to seize the opportunity that judges uniquely have to be drivers of reforms, especially when they identify, you know, unique problems that only they can see, sort of in its full ugliness, is I think a huge part of where the reform movement needs to get to in order to really be effective long term. So,
I'd say one small thing to follow up there. In the middle of that, Doug said, "I don't know the answer to the problem," but then at the end, Doug gave the answer. The answer is that we've got to do something, at least at the federal level, we have to do something to restore balance in the types of people who are appointed to judgeships. You know, that Cato study wasn't just focused on whether or not people had ever been prosecutors. It was focused on the question of whether or not people had ever worked for the government, because that will do something interesting to you institutionally. You will find yourself sympathetic to the case for defending the government and the government's interest. And that's fine, there's a case to be made for that. But there's also a case to be made for, as Holly put it, speaking truth to power. There's a case to be made that you need to have more people in the federal judiciary who don't have that experience of working for government. Instead, they've had experience just constantly pushing against government, whether that means that they were doing it as criminal defense attorneys or even whether that means that they were doing it in the civil sector, in the regulatory space. You just want people who have been challenging the arguments of government power and government authority throughout their careers. The whole judiciary doesn't have to look like that, but certainly this kind of 80-20 balance is well out of whack.
So with that, we're out of time. If anybody wants to end on a cheery note, you're more than welcome.
Buckeyes are number one in the latest. Sorry, I didn't do that for Holly. Right? But well, Kentucky looked great last night.
I was
going
to say,
there you go.
Kentucky played a game last night.
There's not any Michigan State fans, but I mean, everybody's all tore up over the election on Twitter, and I'm like, please. You know, I'm so above that now in my bipartisanship. But Kentucky Wildcats, no offense, but
no, I
feel like we're rightly superior on the basketball
field. Yes, you are. So, justifiably right. So.
Well, I'll say one cheerful thing, and it's not about the University of Texas football team, trust me. For a panel like this to be useful, we have to talk about challenges and problems and things that, you know, we need to work harder on. And so that's what we did. But don't let that spoil the fact that we're in a great moment. You'd want to work on criminal justice because it's the one place where there are bipartisan, transpartisan things happening. Successful things have been happening at the state and federal level. We're in a happy time at the moment.
Well, with that, please join me in thanking our panel.